And I'm thrilled that we're all here. It's great to have the Nidler RTC and extended family here. This is a great event. I was also thinking that, you know, I'm glad we left the Secretary of Agriculture back in the safe room in case something were to happen here. We're in good shape in this world that we're in. I do have to have say that I have no financial conflicts of interest. Here are some of the funding I receive and some consulting, and obviously need to give great thanks to Nidler for RRTC funding now in ending our 16th year as an RRTC and other miscellaneous funding. I didn't fully realize how much I would love this work in this area that I was never trained in as a clinical psychologist. And I'll tell you that story a little bit. So back in the day, I also love that we're talking about how our centers were born, kind of what was going on. And I don't know if everybody remembers how our center was born. And Leslie, I don't even know if you were at NIDR at the time, but in 2000, and I think it was late 2002, there was an announcement for our two RTCs on community integration. The Olmsted decision happened in 1999, but the competition was open to six different disability populations, including, so they were gonna fund two, including one, University of Minnesota was up. They have had a longstanding RTC in community integration, community living and participation for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So I saw this announcement and didn't really think about it, and was banging my head on NIMH reviewers, trying to get them to fund peer support research and sending in proposals, and they just didn't get it. And you know, now everybody adds peer support and you get it funded, even though I'm sitting there going, that's not peer support. What, you know, that doesn't make any sense. But that's another story. But I was having lunch one day with somebody named Don Delario that some of you know. Don had been at BU at one point, and I'm remembering this because I see Don once a year since he retired. He is a big Baltimore Ravens fan. He's got amazing tickets, 50-yard line, first row, behind the visitors, and he invites me to a game once a year, and I go this Sunday, so I'll be there cheering the Ravens against the Browns. But we're sitting there having lunch, and Don said, why don't you apply for this thing? I'm like, me? What am I going to do? I don't know what community integration is, right? And they're not going to fund me. Are you kidding? And then I left that lunch and said, oh, what the heck? Let me see what we can do. And it's been the best decision I could have made. Speaking of fun, I've had a lot of fun, but I've also had a lot of fun doing work that we think is very important. This is a graph of terms, it's a Google Scholar search involving the terms community integration, community inclusion, and mental illness. So the bottom line is community inclusion and mental illness. The blue line, the middle one, is community integration and mental illness. And the top line is the combination of the two. That'd be kind of the grayish line. And you can see we came at a really nice point. I'd like to think that we should take some credit for some of that. I can't prove it, that our center has been involved in that, except I'm gonna try to prove it in a second, or make you think, hey, they're responsible for this big increase. But I've gotta tell you, and I'll share some of the work we've been doing, some of the research, some of the target areas. We've really tried to focus on innovation. We had an interesting discussion before about incremental approaches to change, or kind of innovative paradigm shift, revolutionary change. And I've got to say, I mean, I love both of them, right? They're both important. We've really, from the get-go, tried to be more that innovation and really push the envelope and really try to challenge what's going on in our field. What's going on is not enough. I've done a lot of work in Israel lately, and I did some teaching of a course, and students, they were involved in a lot of psych rehab programs in Israel, terrific programs, and they would tell me all the great things they're doing in their programs, and I'd say, that's great, but have you thought about this, and this, and this, and they start getting frustrated with me, and I asked a colleague, how do you say not enough So I started, I introduced myself. There was a final kind of conference and I was able to be a keynote. And I referred to myself as Professor Loma Speak. Right, Yara? I'm saying it correctly. Loma Speak, Professor Not Enough. And I would like us to leave this room. I want us to be happy with what we've been doing, right? But not enough. We've got a lot more to do. And I think along with our incremental change, we need to be revolutionary. And I'll try to make this a short story. One reason I love doing what we get to do is early on in our center, probably in those first couple years, we developed a measure that we called the Temple University Community Participation Measure. And it asks how many days in the last 30 days did you participate in these different areas? What's important to you? Did you do it enough, not enough, or too much? We call that sufficiency. And I had no idea how this was gonna work and were people gonna get it? And gosh, I can barely remember what I did 2 days ago. How am I gonna remember last 30 days? And people would say, how would somebody with serious mental illness remember how they're gonna, you know, what they did the last 30 days? But my research staff were going out administering this measure and I was curious how things were going. And, you know, work for pay, doing things with friends, hanging out, going to movies, going to cultural events, these kinds of things. And my staff would come back and I would say, how are things going with this measure? How is this working with people? And what they said still breaks my heart now. I almost choke up every time I say this. What they would say is people love it, right? People with serious mental illnesses, schizophrenia, spectrum disorder, bipolar disorder, major depression in the public health system. People love it. I said, well, why? What are they saying? They love it because nobody ever asks me these things. Nobody ever asks me these things. That is a problem. Okay. And we still hear that today. Just yesterday, we were doing some work in Delaware. A wonderful person, I didn't know this person's story before, but that was basically her story. She was told, take your medications, let's pay attention to symptoms. We were talking about this at lunch. She was talking about, don't work right now, might not be able to work again, don't think about that other stuff. And that was the wrong thing to do. And that is part of what we're trying to do with our center. One of the major things that we're trying to focus on is making the case for the medical necessity of this stuff that we're doing here, that we're talking about, no longer allowing people to view this as kind of a little ancillary thing. I was in Australia once, somebody said, like, the good on ya, right? Hey, that's really nice, that's really cute. We're gonna do this important stuff and you do that little cute stuff over there. And I don't think we should accept that anymore, right? But we also need to pull together the data to show that it isn't just a good on ya, right? This is a medically necessary area that we all work in. This is important. This is as important as anything else we can do as a mental health treatment, okay? That is something that we tried to do in this Well Together document. This document, we were approached by an organization in Australia to pull together the evidence base behind community inclusion for people with serious mental illnesses, but it was also wanted us to have a cross-disability orientation. What is the evidence base? Making the medical necessity argument. I put this up here because we got this out there in 2016. It really got some traction. We're getting a lot of calls these days related to this kind of thing because people are grabbing onto this medical necessity thing. People are getting it. And we also laid out 11 fundamentals of evidence-based fundamentals for promoting community inclusion. People are also grabbing onto that as well. We were talking about evidence-based practices, and we've really tried to promote these fundamental principles that we need to pay attention to because everybody is an individual, right? Interests are individual, the supports, the barriers, and that's one thing we'll talk about in a second, are also individualized. We've paid certainly a lot of attention to doing good quality research and getting that research out in the peer-reviewed literature. But one of the things I think we're most proud of is, first of all, anytime anybody asks us to do a presentation, we do it. So we're out there and we say yes, and we say yes, and we say yes, and we say yes, because we're talking about dissemination this morning. And I think somebody kind of hinted at this. I think the most critical part of the effect of effective implementation, science, or dissemination is relationships, right? If somebody heard something at a presentation, or they happen to stumble across something on a Google search, we can talk about this fancy implementation science, which I believe in, but this is, people find out because folks are out there getting the stuff out there. Right? So that's what we've been doing. The other thing we've been doing is, just like our colleagues, really creating usable documents that translate the evidence, the work we're doing and the work that other people are doing, into usable information, especially in unique areas, novel areas that aren't talked about as much. So we have documents on dating and intimacy. My favorite document is the one, it's using motivational interviewing around dating and intimacy, developed by a colleague. But what I like about it is it's not directed at consumers or peers, it's directed at providers. Using motivational interviewing with providers to get them to start talking to people about what's important in their lives. Intimacy and intimate relationships. Passion is a word that I've heard people use as well. We talk about parenting. We try to get information out to folks. So these are some of the strategies that we've been using. So my approach for the time that I have is to try to quickly go through some of our target areas. And this is hard for all of us, even though we're still kind of the new kid on the block. Even in a short period of time, it's sometimes hard to say this is what we're about. But these are things that have been kind of guiding principles for our center over the last 16 years. The first target area or guiding principle is to increase knowledge in relatively unexplored areas. College students with serious mental illnesses, what is their experience? Parenting, we look at religion and dating. Looking at, instead of how cognition takes away from participation, neurocognition, we're interested in how does participation and lack of participation affect neurocognition? There is lots and lots of research that participation impacts our brains, right? One of them I'm being constrained with a little bit now because Judith has confined me to this spot. Some of you have seen me work before. I'm like one of these people. I'm moving, I'm doing this stuff. And she said, we want to be able to hear you on this thing. But one of them has to do with neurotrophic factor signaling. When a physical activity, not just exercise, just moving around, going from getting out of my house, my couch, going somewhere to sit down to play cards, is still probably decreasing sedentary behavior, activating these neurotrophic factor signals that enhance cognition. So I usually say I like to move around because it makes me sound smarter, right? So I stand here, no neurotrophic factors are going. But that's some of the work we do, looking at developmental approaches to understanding participation. So I just want, I'm not even going to go through this in a lot of detail, but this first one is a study. Zlotka had done a study once, a survey identifying people with serious mental illnesses who were involved in professional jobs, right? I thought that was brilliant because nobody thinks serious mental illness in professional jobs. And I realized that we had no data on college students with mental illnesses. So I did this quick and dirty little survey once, and we looked at things like familiarity with accommodations, use of office of students with disabilities. These are the data that Marianne talked about. We also identified all of the areas that we could think about providing accommodations to college students, because I was tired of talking to offices of students with disabilities, and they say, oh no, the only accommodations we offer are extra time on tests and taking a test in a quiet space. And actually one person, I said, well, what about all these other things you could do? Oh no, that would be illegal to do those other things. What are you talking about? Like, that doesn't make any sense. But the fact of the matter is, they had no clue what else could be done to support college students with mental health issues that could be considered an accommodation. So we did that. I'm gonna digress one other second. So you do this novel work, right? You think you're being novel, parenting, college students, homelessness, whatever. And then you see two people have been there before, right? One is Carol Mowbray, who was an amazing person. Many of us knew her. And the other is Judith Cook. Judith, everything, Judith has been there first before anybody else. And she must have like banged her head on it and said, oh, screw it. Nobody's going to pay for this. I'm going to move on to something else. And then we get to come along 10 years later and go, hey, look at this new novel area. Somebody's going to pay for it. And there Judith was camped out, had it ready to go, and wasn't able to get it funded. So the other area that we've been focusing on as well is looking at normative factors that affect the success of college students with mental health issues. I think Marianne referenced this a little bit. It's not just symptoms, right? It's other stuff that can support students. Certainly accommodations, things that college and universities can do. But we were also interested in the experience of college students on campuses. And one normative factor is campus engagement. Do you go to campus, use campus facilities? Are you involved in clubs and organizations? Do you talk to faculty? What's your relationship with other students? A relationship with administration and faculty? These are normative factors that affect any college student's success. And part of this survey, we found ample evidence that college students with serious mental illnesses were not as engaged on campus as the general student population. And we've developed some different interventions based on that. We don't want it to just be focused on the illness, right, and symptoms of the illness. There's other stuff going on here that we have to pay attention to, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. The other area that we have looked at a lot is parenting. I think I mentioned I'm a psychologist trained. I'll still call myself licensed and dangerous. And we never talked about parenting, right? The assumption is you're either too ill to have children, or I don't even want to think about you having sex and having children, right? We don't talk about it. And we've really been trying to raise awareness of this because in different situations where I've had opportunities to talk to people with serious mental illnesses are as desirous of being parents as anybody else. This is as important to them as it is to anybody else. I have three children. Don't talk to me about recovery if you're not talking to me about my children, right? And we don't talk to people about their children. And we don't support them around relationships with children. This is critically important. So we're continuing to try to raise consciousness, raise awareness about parenting as a big area. Actually, NIDLR has been wonderful in this area. They have historically funded a center focused on parenting of people with disabilities. Brandeis right now has one of these centers. Our colleague Joanne Nicholson is there, working there. And this is such an important area. We need to do a lot more in it. This is a study we just published. I saw Lisa had to leave because that was the other Lisa, to plug the study that they've accepted in psych services. We did a national survey and identified again that people with serious mental illnesses are as likely to be parents as the general population. And they're much, 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 much more likely to be involved in the child protective service area and to lose contact to their children. 26 times more likely to lose, have a change in their living arrangement. Oh no, don't do that. I mean, I have this memorized a little bit, but this is more fun to be able to point up to this. So this is critically important. We're just trying to get our field fired up about it. Any provider that does not talk to people about parenting, other than, are you a parent, do you have children, oh great, write that in my notes. So let's talk about your depression, getting out of bed, whatever. I mean, that we need to do more than we're doing now. And we need to support people in regaining custody of their children. The other target area, obviously, is novel interventions. And what we heard here today is these centers, the kind of work that NIDLR funds, is incredibly novel. This is what should be done. There should be these kinds of interventions that are funded, and unfortunately, not everybody gets that. But NIDLR definitely gets that. So we've had an opportunity to develop and look at interventions in the education area, leisure, recreation, parenting, transportation, self-direction that I'll talk about in a second, and then look at different populations, people who have been in the criminal justice system, and look at community participation and living for those individuals, people who have been homeless. Self-directed care area, again, Judith Cook right there, been there, done that, continuing to do the work. So we have to kind of figure out a way that we can do something new in this area. just having fun, Judith. This is one of our publications where we were really taking this community inclusion and participation orientation to understanding self-direction. What are the kinds of things that people want to purchase or utilize their kind of discretionary or non-traditional funding resources for. You're not going to be able to read this. I think we're going to send out the PowerPoint presentation later. But one thing you'll see is people are looking for resources in areas related to community living and participation. This suggests to me that self-directed care can help fill a gap in our traditional service system related to community living and participation. We know that community living and participation is a medical necessity. Work is good for our brains and our wellness and our physical health. Education is good for our brains, our physical health, and our mental health. Dating is good for people. Parenting is good for people. Leisure recreation is good for people. All of these things are medically necessary. Self-directed care can help facilitate that, provide some of the resources to fill that gap. The other thing that we've done, and my colleagues Elizabeth Thomas and Yara Zismanilani are here, they really led this study, really looking at some of the things people said about their experience in self-directed care, and we looked at it from the lens of self-determination and choice, and clearly have some evidence from the comments that people made that they did experience self-determination and choice. And self-determination and choice are evidence-based practices. These are associated with better outcomes in mental health for people with serious mental illnesses. This is stuff we should be focusing on, and self-directed care is one type of intervention. And we have a study that's about to come out that shows that there are some changes in costs associated with self-directed care, some decreases, even though we also see increases in other areas as well. And we've also done an intervention. One, we like to use technology in our center. All of us like to use technology. We just heard the great Pathways RTC work using technology in training. But we developed an online intervention for parents with serious mental illnesses to provide education, peer support, these kinds of things. Our colleague Katie Kaplan was the director of this work. There you see some of the page views of some of the snapshots of this website, and we found that this intervention had some long-term benefits in terms of parental satisfaction. Those folks that were involved in this online intervention, where they had a chance to learn more about parenting and child development and how to parent as a person with lived experience and interactions, opportunities to interact with other parents with mental health issues, that they had positive outcomes. The third area is, I was trying to think of what to call it, but I decided to call it the social model of disability and expanding our understanding or perspectives or taking a perspective on environmental and geographic, environment and geography as it pertains to people with serious mental illnesses. The reason we focus on this is one of, I mentioned before, like we said, community integration in mental health. Isn't that just people? Isn't that just deinstitutionalization? Boy, have I learned a lot since from the broader disability community, right? They have been talking about community integration and inclusion and community living and participation for a long, long time. In mental health, we talk about recovery, which is great. We talk about community integration sometimes. You saw not very much, but when we do, it's in terms of deinstitutionalization. And The idea is we wanted to bring some of these concepts into mental health that folks just, we just don't talk about it enough. Social model of disability is one of them. We do presentations all over the place. When I talk to big audiences and say, how many people, providers, case managers, peers, residential programs, policymakers, how many people know what the social model of disability is? Nobody raises their hands. Oh, I could do this here. Hopefully more than Judith and Sean would raise their hands. Don't scare me. I thought about asking, but I was like, of course everybody knows. But I tell you what, folks do not know. And if they do raise their hands, they're either occupational therapists or recreational therapists. Social model of disability, and then I do my thing. All the staff at the center laugh at me because I do a thing. Well, let me explain. Here's Mark. Mark has schizophrenia. You fix Mark. That's the individual model of disability, right? Mark is disabled because he has schizophrenia. You fix Mark, okay? That's how we reduce the disability. Social model of disability looks like this. Here's Mark, here's with schizophrenia, here's the environment. There's no overlap between them. There's not a good fit. That's what leads to the experience of disability, okay? You can fix Mark and reduce the impairment to a certain extent and decrease the experience of disability, maybe get a, you know, increase our percentage of people employed by 10% or something, you know, which is awesome, very important. Or we can do something about the environment. I mentioned prejudice and discrimination before. It's huge, it's huge, it's huger than huge. It is humongous, it is triply huge. This is a big thing that we need to pay more attention to. And more than May is Mental Health Month, and the second week of October is Recovery Week or whatever we call it. It's gotta be all the time because this is an environmental barrier that is whacking people in all of these participation areas. Transportation's an issue, poverty's an issue, access to resources, social determinants of health, right? That's what we're talking about here. And that's what our center is trying to take a look at. We have one of my favorite studies that we're involved in is identifying, we've interviewed 90 people, and we've said, tell us about a place where you feel welcomed as a person with a mental illness. Right? What are the physical characteristics, the social characteristics, the sensory characteristics? We want to identify what are the things in the environments that you feel create a good fit for you, right? So that's one study that we're doing, and hopefully you'll see those results soon. We've done studies using GIS, geographic information systems, even to identify where people live. Right? And do they live differently than other people, which, boy, might explain high unemployment or use of substances or involvement in the criminal justice system. Maybe it's not the mental illness or all mental illness. Maybe there are other things going on, just like everybody else. There's other things going on. This was one study where we identified that people with serious mental illnesses seem to live in slightly more segregated areas, at least in Philadelphia. We think this applies to other communities as well, compared to other poor people, okay? So there's evidence of modest segregation of people with serious mental illnesses in Philly. And we've done some follow-up research funded by NIDLR where we've looked at, why are people living there? And what are the implications of that? So sometimes people say, well, they live there because that's where the residential programs are. That's not the case in Philadelphia. They live there because their friends are there. They live there because, you know, I like living where there's a lot of substance use and unemployment and the neighborhoods are in disrepair and buildings are falling down. No, people live there because that's where the housing is affordable, right? Just like anybody else, people live where they can afford to live. If you get $881 a month, you can't spend too much on your housing, right? Most people with serious mental illnesses do not live in residential programs. Philadelphia is fortunate. We provide funding where about 20% of people with serious mental illnesses live in residential programs. 80% of people on Medicaid with a psychiatric disability are not in a residential program, and it's much a higher rate in other communities. We've done studies where we found that this means people with serious mental illnesses are exposed to more social problems, more crime, more substance use. All of these kinds of things are going on. And you're just going to have to, you know, look for those articles and read them and enjoy them the way that we've enjoyed putting them together. The other type of work that we've done is we've looked at how where you live affects community participation and community living, especially looking at rural-urban differences or urban-non-urban differences, and find that living in urban communities, maybe not surprisingly, is associated with greater participation and greater sense of community. I think somebody commented before on the importance of looking at rural issues. First of all, 20% of the U.S. population lives in more rural communities, less urban or suburban. That's not a lot of people, but it is a lot of people. So we do need to pay attention to that. And we've looked at how car access affects participation of people as well. I wanted to quickly mention some work we're doing related to GPS. Yes, we are having people with serious mental illnesses carry around cell phones. Oh, Lisa Dixon sent me a nice email. Look at that. carry around cell phones, smartphones, and we are tracking them. Initially, we were worried about that. My colleague, Eugene Brusilovsky, sent an email to his friends on Facebook and said, hey, would any of you be willing to be tracked using GPS? Because we were concerned that funders wouldn't like this and reviewers wouldn't like it, actually. They'd say, oh, people with serious mental illness, they don't want to be tracked. Eugene's friends wrote back and said, absolutely not. We would not want to be tracked, all that. And we went to a drop-in center, and a couple drop-in centers asked people, would you be willing to be tracked with a smartphone everywhere you went? And like almost everybody said, yeah, sure, no problem. Then we realized that Eugene is from Russia originally, and a lot of his friends are also from the former Soviet Union, and they probably were being tracked with maybe not GPS, maybe it was somebody at the time. But so we've done this work, and really we do this work because we're interested in understanding people's mobility. How do they get around? How much time are people spending out of the house? What is there? I'll show you this activity space. How many different destinations are people going to? So we're thinking about it. This is important to understand descriptively what mobility and participation looks like for people with serious mental illnesses, but also the possibility of using this in outcome studies or a way of looking at the impact of the interventions. So this is how the data look: longitude, latitude, time, date stamp. By the way, the brilliant person behind this, I mean, I've got the smart ideas, but from an implementation or technology standpoint, that is all Eugene Brusilovsky, right? I would not be able to take these data and do anything with them. I come up with the big ideas, and then Eugene figures out the brilliant way of making it work for us. This is actually what the data kind of look like when you map them out. The dots are all kind of transportation or transition points. The stars are what we call destinations, places where people go for extended periods of time. This is actually one day in Eugene's life. He tracked himself. This is the kind of data we can get. Activity space is the area in which somebody travels or moves around in a certain period of time. So each of those, there's a yellow line, a blue line, a green line, purple line, and a brown line. Those represent different days in somebody's life. These are actual data, and the sum of that is kind of that shaded area on the bottom that gives a sense of the activity space. So this person's activity space, at least in this five-day period, is somewhat restricted. This is the range of area that somebody travels in. This is somebody else's activity space, and you say they have a broader region. I've been trying to coin a new word, opportunity space, that the more activity space, the larger, the more opportunities somebody might have to participate in different areas. But I haven't figured out a way to get that in a publication. So if you do it, if you use it, please cite me. You all heard that Mark Salzer said this on whatever day this is today. So look, our impacts, a lot of the impacts are really related to our materials. We get people coming up to us all the time. It just happened another couple times the last few days. We use this document. It was somebody in the autism area has been using our documents related to dating, I think, and religion. right? That's awesome. We're really happy that that happens. We try to put things out and say, hey, if you're using our stuff, tell us about it, because Nidler likes to know this kind of stuff, and some people respond, some people don't. We also have had an impact with our concepts and principles and approaches with in Philadelphia, with the transformation of the day programs there. In the VA, we've had a lot of impact. And we talked about managed care and funders, Magellan Behavioral Health Programs. This has actually been an area that we've developed some products to help managed care companies as they contract with providers, right? They're the payers. Put in your request in your contracts to focus on real community participation, community living. Put that in your contracts, and also how to hold managed care companies responsible for some of these outcomes. I don't know why somebody doesn't say, okay, what is your current employment rate in your county or catchment area or whatever? Okay, it's 3% or 10% or whatever. In the next 3 years, you need to get that up to 13%. And you need to have surveys that show an increase of 10% in the number of people who say that somebody has talked to them and encouraged them to work, right? Those are some of the things that I would love to see. We do have a couple of initiatives right now in North Carolina, Delaware, and New York State. There are a bunch of things happening. Some of our other impacts is we're really big on kind of giving our stuff away. And sometimes people are surprised about this, but Matthew Federici, who's been an old friend of mine at the Copeland Center, has been very happy to take our stuff and create a whole new certification process in the peer specialist area around community inclusion specialists, using our fundamentals and our approaches, because we believe that peers are probably the best folks for promoting community living and participation. And the last area I'm going to mention is, for some reason, the autism area, where I have learned, I sometimes will say, I have stolen everything I know from the broad disability community, right? Especially the intellectual and developmental disabilities community. Something has happened in part of that community where they don't remember this stuff anymore, and they're coming to me. To ask me to help them around community living and participation. So fine, we're doing some great stuff. Some stuff funded by Nidler, looking at transportation issues for young adults on the autism spectrum. I can't even remember all this stuff, peer specialists focused on community living and participation, right? That's pretty cool. That's a nice impact. That's happening in Philadelphia. I had the New Kids on the Block, RRTC. We were the New Kids on the Block in 2003. I used to always say that it felt like moving into a neighborhood where there were all these big mansions, really well established. And here, little old me, you know, I had the little shack at the end of the street that people kind of drove by fast because they didn't know what was happening in there. But it's been really great to be part of the RRTC and Nidler family. I do think we are the flag bearers among all the funded entities out there in terms of talking about the ADA and Olmstead and participation and self-determination. Other folks are not paying attention to this critical stuff, and this is unique. I think we're also broadening perspectives on health, especially the International Classification of Health, Functioning, and Disease. That is the other thing where I'll ask people to raise their hands. You know, these are our provider colleagues, policymakers, funders, smart people, good people. How many people know the ICF framework? Yep, I didn't think so. Oh, no, I know. I'm sorry. I did it again. I was talking to myself, right? Nobody will raise their hands, right? This is important. This is something that we do in this community. I think we're innovators partly because we're allowed to think about and get funding for stages of research, right? Descriptive, early research, early intervention, really try some novel stuff, and I believe that's unique. I think we are unique from an influencer standpoint because our centers really, we are charged. It's part of our mission to not only do research, but to also translate this into practice, right? And that is still unique, even though other folks are starting to pay attention to it. We are the bridgers between mental health and fellow disability communities. A lot of us have worked with the broader disability community in the past, and it's something that we can do more of. We've taken leadership roles in the field and certainly educated the new folks and emerging folks, because unfortunately, people aren't exposed to these areas in their graduate education, right? We're not hearing about this in mental health, at least. You gotta come from other disciplines to hear about some of these kinds of things. I am not gonna do this. Michelle Mullen said, Mark, no, don't do this. Don't talk about your current stuff, what you guys are doing. Let's just talk about this. She said that. So the only thing I wanna say is we are, we call our kind of broader initiative the Temple University Collaborative on Community Inclusion of Individuals with Psychiatric Disabilities. The collaborative part of it has been very intentional from the get-go. Just like what Janet was talking about, you can't talk about kind of integration and inclusion without a broad range of people, without people with lived experience and other folks being part of the work, right? So here are some of our partners in this work. Here are all of our brilliant, wonderful studies that we're doing now, and I will say this. I've mentioned we need to focus on this medical necessity stuff. We need to make this case even stronger than it is now. There's good data out there, but we can do a better job. And this will get, I have gotten some phone calls from Medicaid directors around the U.S. They haven't budged yet, right? They haven't changed anything. They're really intrigued. I'm intentionally provocative about this medical necessity thing, because if you see any state criteria for medical necessity, it's so broad, anything fits. And there's somebody somewhere making a decision about what counts as medical necessity. And I think we can make the case that the kind of stuff we've been talking about today, this counts, okay? The self-determination, I wanna make sure I mention again, Liz and Yara's work related to looking at decision-making issues, promoting self-determination in coordinated specialty care and services in general, and really promoting self-determination everywhere is critically important, because people with lived experience do not have opportunities to make decisions that affect their own lives, and it's something we should be promoting. The last thing I'm just gonna mention, because we wanna have conversation, is the social model of disability thing. Right? This is really important for us to pay attention to. I am, before I retire, I hope that we get to a point where people understand that the lack of participation that we currently see for people with serious mental illnesses is just as likely due to these environmental factors as it is to illness factors. This is important. I believe it. I think it's gonna be true. There are some hints about it and some of the evidence that's out there if we are open to looking at it. And I think this is important partly to create more effective interventions for people where we're also paying attention to the environment. And this is hard stuff too. None of us in our disciplines, those of us in the health professions, you know, we're not usually taught how to address environmental barriers that somebody experiences, right? We know how to do other things to fix the person, right? But we haven't been taught this stuff. But almost every discipline has competencies related to attending to these environmental barriers. We just ignore them. Psych rehab has these competencies, and we don't implement them. We don't pay attention to them. It's critically important from an intervention effectiveness standpoint. I think IPS combined, and I want to do this study with Kim, IPS combined with a robust, effective environmental intervention is going to get another 10% increase in employment outcomes. So Kim, let's write that grant proposal and get that funded. And the other reason this is important is it'll keep us from, it'll hopefully diminish our blaming the person with lived experience about their current state of participation. No, it's not because you're disabled, right? It's not because your brain is all kaflooey and messed up with serotonin things and enlarged ventricles. And, you know, that stuff might be going on, but there's other things going on here. And we need to remember that. That stuff is part of it, but there's other stuff too. We can promote more effective interventions and stop blaming people. And one of those is creating welcoming and embracing environments. I'll end with this. There was a story on CNN the other day about a family traveling with a young boy on the autism spectrum. I don't know if anybody saw this. And it was a long distance trip. They usually had taken shorter flights. And for some reason, the kid was, this flight was not working for him this particular day, and he wouldn't sit in his parents' lap, and he wanted to be on the floor, and he eventually started going around kicking chairs, making noises, doing whatever. The flight attendants let this child lie on the floor, right? There's something about the sensory stimulation related to that that was good for this young child, and the flight attendants got this. The kid made his way up to first class, right? Oh my God, you know, they intentionally did this in CNN because we're all thinking of that story about first class, right? And we know who sits up there. Those people are gonna, you know, complain. Apparently, these folks up in first class were so welcoming and embracing, kicked their chairs, whatever. They started reading, they started entertaining, they started doing stuff to engage this child. That is a welcoming and embracing environment. And that is the kind of stuff we can promote for adults with serious mental illnesses in work environments and educational environments and community environments and faith communities. We've been spending a lot of time talking to folks in faith communities who are concerned about that person who wants to lie on the floor every once in a while during our service. That's okay. Why is that a problem? Why can't we welcome and embrace that? So let's go ahead and have some engaging conversation. I don't have a cute picture of all of our center staff. I'm feeling kind of guilty about it when I saw it, but I did try to create as comprehensive of a list of our investigators, and I just gave up with our other staff because we do have a lot of them. So I look forward to comments and questions folks have.